Have more news at 10 on Letters and Politics. Be sure to join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
Right now, we are on MacArthur, headed towards the freeway entrance of 580. People are shouting, whose street? Our street. What up, fam? How you doing, brother? How's it going, man? What's going on?
Oh, man, you know, it's justice for Trayvon, man. You know, justice for all black brothers who've been killed out here unjustified. And we're going to stand up for them all today, man. So this is how we're going to do it, and we're going to keep doing it until we get some type of answers.
We're
never going to get the answers, so we're going to keep doing it.
There you go. So right now, people are headed to the freeway. There's only one cop car there. There's others coming, trying to see a way to kettle folks in. They're driving on the sidewalk. Right now, you see the police driving on the sidewalk as we speak and actually trying to run after people. Wow. So right now, you have a standoff with the police as they're trying to get on 580. Many of the police are now filming folks, and they're not trying to let people walk on the freeway. There might be about 25 cops there. They're trying to make people go up the street, and people are yelling, Trayvon, Trayvon. Yeah, well, what you thinking about this? Why are you out here tonight?
I'm C-Star. I just happen to be in the area. And I understand, feel everyone's pain because Trayvon is my son, too. I have a son, too.
Can you describe to everybody what you're seeing right now?
What I'm seeing right now is a crowd full of heartfelt people that is filled with tired of the injustice that's going on in the United States of America. Because anytime anyone can pull out a gun and kill someone against their own will is unnecessary, and it's taking us all the way back to slavery days.
Right. So tell everybody who can't see, what do you see? We're over here in front of the 580 entrance freeway. What do you see in front of that freeway?
In front of the freeway, I see people on bikes, people on feet, blocking the freeway to get on to the 580 freeway going towards Hayward. There's a crowd of people all the way from Excelsior to Grand. Bunch of people out here in support of this.
You know, what do you think about the fact that so often black people aren't seen as human? Our image is always distorted, and we're always made to seem like we're criminals. What's your thoughts on that, especially since you do have a son?
My thought on that is that people are ignorant, and all they see is what they depict on the TV. But if anyone actually really came and met someone who is flesh and blood and live in God's law, God said we all are equal. It doesn't matter about our skin color. I'm so tired of people think that the blacks are lower than everyone else, but it's not. Every single city in every community has a ghetto. And ghetto is a state of mind. It's not where you live. And now, I didn't see the police at first, but I see all these officers lined up in their riot gear waiting for something to happen.
There you go. They're blocking the freeway entrance. We're going to keep you abreast as to what's happening. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Thanks a lot, sis. That was just a little bit of what we recorded last night. And the question that I was putting to most of the folks that I came across was the question of image. And again and again and again, I heard it. It was very heartfelt, very painfully felt by many that felt that the images that are often levied on them as black people, black men and black women, is just a straight up assault. It's not something that people are co-signing to a lot of times, but that would not be seen like. Many people don't realize that because of the way it's presented in the mainstream media, the way that it seems to be celebrated. It seems to be profited by so many companies to the point that it's the norm. And I wanted to focus on the image because when you're just hearing about the remarks of the juror who spoke yesterday, and she was just like, oh, you know, Rachel Jontel just was not credible, you know, and I feel sorry for George Zimmerman. And, you know, of course, Trayvon, he had to be a thug. You have that type of sentiment, and it's coming because of the type of imagery that is associated with us as black folks. I mean, from the days that we were brought over here from Africa, we were seen as less than human, and there's been an all-out attempt to continue to have that perception based around us. I wanted to talk to our first guest, who's in the building. His name is Mark Anthony Neal. He is no stranger to this type of conversation. He's a scholar and a professor over at Duke, but he put out a book called Looking for Leroy, and it's talking about the illegible black masculinity. So, Mark, welcome to the show, and sorry for getting tongue-tied. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on, Davey.
You know, I know when you wrote the book, you weren't thinking, or maybe you were, about the Trayvon trial, but now that it's out, everything that you probably put in this book is very relevant, and I wanted to maybe start with the premise of that and how black male image in this case is really connected and front and center to what we're experiencing and what we're probably going to continue to experience from, you know, moving forward.
You know, it's funny, Davey. I usually write the introductions to my book last, you know, so that I can contextualize in a certain kind of way. And in the introduction, I actually had to go back to insert a little language about Trayvon because it did speak to some of the images that I tried to talk about in the book in terms of the ways that black men and black boys are legible, are readable, are recognizable to us in certain kinds of ways, and the way that they aren't recognizable to us in certain kinds of ways. So when I've talked about the book publicly, the example that I've used is that if we see a black man with a basketball, everybody thinks they knows what that means. We don't even have to process that. We don't have to think second about that. We know what that is. We see a black man with a violin, a black boy with a violin. That gives us so many reasons to pause. Why does he have this violin? Where did he learn to play it? Did he steal it from somebody? How can he afford to have a violin? Just all these questions that are bombarded with these images. So I was trying in the book to kind of work through some of this imagery. The thing about Trayvon Martin that's important to remember, particularly in the context of the trial, is that for George Zimmerman and particularly for the jurors, this idea of black masculinity as being thugs, as being thuggish, as being criminal, there's very little space in the society for them to think about black men and boys in any other kind of way. For them, that is the normative view of who black men and boys are. Something that has people who have to be contained, that have to be policed, that have to be controlled, and a worst case scenario, they have to be incarcerated. So if that is the status quo for how the society looks at black men and boys, it means it poses lots of challenges for us to be able to work around these kind of dynamics. I mean, it's in this way that stand your ground laws were constructed to deal with this idea of what black masculinity is. You know, when we think about the stuff that's going on in New York in terms of stop and frisk. I mean, literally, these are laws that are erected as a way to contain this idea of black men being dangerous.
You know, when, you know, if you could put on, for example, your other hat, you know, being somebody who's been involved with the music industry, which is a primary disseminator of black male image. Can you talk a little bit about how this image is kind of contained in popular culture, in the sense of you can only be a certain type of image. You could be a crooner, or you got to be this thug artist, and how that becomes a profit-driven type of entity that, you know, we all, well, we can see we're suffering from that now.
I think, and that's part of what I try to talk about in the book, you know, what are these kind of images of black men that we know about, you know, how are these different artists and other figures trying to push back against the boundaries that are imposed upon them? You know, we both came up in terms of trying to read through when hip hop really becomes this major commercial force in the 1990s. And in order to cross over, everybody had to look a certain kind of way. You had to act a certain kind of way. When you think about an artist like Kwame, who early in his career is walking around wearing polka dots and stuff like that, and he's getting told, well, that's an image that we can't use anymore, right? You have to pick up a gun and all these kinds of things. And I think hip-hop becomes an easy scapegoat in this context. You know, what we've seen, particularly over the last decade or so, is so many hip-hop artists who are trying to push back against that kind of dynamic. Say what you will about Jay-Z and his politics, but in terms of his image politics, the way that he's constructed himself, he's very clearly trying to push away his idea that he was this drug dealer in Brooklyn. When you think about someone like Kanye, you know, the reason why he was so interesting to us in the beginning is because he went against type. When you think about an Andre 3000, I mean, I can name all the names of the folks that we're comfortable with now. Someone like Drake, you know, folks might hate, might not like Drake's music, you know, in terms of whether or not it's quote unquote real hip hop. But in terms of what he's doing in terms of the image of black masculinity, he's clearly doing something that's different. But I think it's important when we think about hip-hop and even wanting to blame hip-hop in this conversation because, you know, for many folks in white America, you know, even think about, you know, George Zimmerman's response when he's trying to tell the story about what Trayvon said to him, like, you're going to die today. Like, this is some hip-hop video from 1992. If you're, like, real young black men talk like that in 2013. But, you know, there was no hip-hop when the Scottsboro boys were arrested, right? Mm-hmm. This is a longer narrative in which the large society find some sort of image that they can monetize, that they can commodify, and circulate throughout popular culture and the media as something that white America needs to be afraid of. So whether or not that is, you know, the rapist that needed to be lynched in the 18th and 19th and early 20th century, you know, whether or not that was the drugged out jazz artists of the 1940s and 50s that was undermining, you know, the sanctity of American society, or whether or not that's the gangster rapper in 1990, we consistently go back to these images.
You know, if from a scholarly point of view, what's at play that, I mean, you gave a historical understanding of how these images have been front and center for a very long time. But just looking at how they rest now in institutions and policy is built around those images, you know, I wanted to play the clip from the demonstration last night because a couple of things happened. When it was first reported, you know, on the news, the rallies and everything that were going on were pretty peaceful. There was no problems. And the reporters that were there saw that. But when I went home, you know, and turned on the TV, maybe about 10 minutes later, those same reporters were like, well, it's violent, it's scary, it's, you know, they were putting those adjectives out there, which of course start to play into everything, and eventually it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so there's a few things that seem to be at play. One, it's profitable to keep this negative, dehumanized image in motion.
Absolutely.
And then the other question that raises, that wants to be raised is, how much of it do we start to buy into and make that a self-fulfilling prophecy? So there's a couple of things, but just even looking at how policies, so you have the news media, they say this, the police show up, there's about 50 of them, you know, in riot gear, they have all the tanks, the six helicopters overhead, and this is not just in Oakland, they did this in every city across the United States, you know, where there were rallies in anticipation for, you know, this violence that they automatically just assumed and just were literally counting on to happen.
So, you know, there are a couple of things. I 2 months before Trayvon is killed, the Opportunity Gender, which is one of these foundations come out of New York run by Allen Jenkins, issued an incredible report about the role that the images, that the way that black male and black boys and black men, the images of black men and boys circulate throughout the culture and how it is directly connected to policy around black men and boys. In school institutions, the prison industrial complex, everyday interactions with folks. Mm. And so this research is out there. What I think is really important is the way, as you suggest, David, that we as a community kind of buy into that. And I would argue that even our closing ranks around Trayvon Martin and his family is a product of that process. You know, Trayvon Martin is not the first black boy, black teen that was an unarmed and was killed by, you know, someone who didn't see him as deserving to be in a particular place. I mean, there's hundreds of these stories in our history. There have been hundreds of these cases since Trayvon Martin, none of them getting the kind of traction. And part of what Trayvon represented is that in some ways he was the right kind of victim. And what I mean by that is that he spoke broadly in the black community and any white communities to this idea of a good middle class black kid who did not deserve to be killed. And my whole point is that if we're actually going to move the needle on these kinds of issues, particularly about the way that the larger society criminalizes black men, we have to be able and be willing to protect Pookie and Nene the same way we protect Trayvon Martin. Because while Pookie might have his hand in the game a little bit, you know, if he is unarmed and he's killed, he's innocent at that moment. And whatever he was involved with before doesn't matter, right? We need to protect the fact that all these men deserve our protection and our support, you know, when they are killed in the ways that Trayvon Martin was killed. And the underlying a lot of that is that we also believe that Trayvon Martin has had a future.
Right.
And what gets shut out is that future in ways that we don't believe that Pookie and the cats on the corner have futures.
What I want to do is I want to bring into the conversation a guest in our studio, Reefa One. If Reefa, if you could grab that mic. And I wanted to bring Reefa because Reefa, of course, legendary graph writer from the Bay Area, spray can artist. But more importantly, Reefa, as an activist, works with a lot of the young men in terms of not only getting them to open up their minds and see things differently, but he's also very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? Discipline about making sure that art that he puts out, that his people put out, really hits to the soul of folks and knows how it's a powerful tool and is constantly battling the beast, so to speak. So, Reefa, just in terms of the conversation we're talking about with, you know, just male images and knowing that you work with a lot of the male, you know, young brothers that would be at Trayvon's age, how do you see them navigating their own image versus, you know, what you're trying to teach them, what you're trying to work with them and cultivate versus the type of things that they're constantly being fed?
Hey, good morning, peoples. Our community is struggling with that image, and it's one of the reasons why I feel that it's very important for the resurgence of the maturity and the critical analysis that hip-hop was born with to come back. This isn't something new, and we're not reinventing the wheel, but what we are doing is filling the void that is being created by mass media that has given our young people an appetite for an image of their degradation.
Mm. You know, when we were just talking about this whole profiting or this institutionalization of our image that leads to profit, how do we start to really combat that? And even though we know it's historical, a lot of people don't necessarily realize that's going on, that there's a celebration and there's a profiting of black death. More music is sold when an artist is going to jail or an artist is dead than when he's alive. And that becomes a business model. Tupac would be a perfect example. And we can go through a list of artists who, once they got out of jail, their sales went up. And now we actually see major labels and we see TV shows that are now looking for that type of person to really highlight and market. I'll tell a story, and maybe you might remember this, Mark, because you're from New York. And maybe, Reefa, you might remember this, too. When The Message first came out by Grandmaster Flash, it excited a lot of people in the community for the first time we got a chance to hear something that expressed our reality. Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the steps like they just don't care. And that was kind of, you know, like, you know, somebody's talking about my pain is one type of sentiment that people felt. But I also remember people in the industry saying things like, you know, the way Melly Mel expresses himself, the way he's so angry and, you know, that black rage. And the next thing you know, it's like, we need more of this. We need more of this rage. So it's almost like the alarm is not to fix the conditions that he's talking about. The alarm is, how can we get more people who sound like that rage? And so you go scouring through the worst type of scenarios that people are enduring to bring that out so you can put it on a pedestal and say, look at this guy, you know, expresses anger, and what he's angry about never gets fixed.
Right.
Go ahead, Reefa.
Well, you know, the thing about The Message, it was so amazing, not to mention the poetic genius behind Melly Mel's work, was that it didn't just talk about the pain, but he was able to articulate and bring focus to things that weren't being addressed. And there is a need for us to have anger and rage. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it has been perverted in the industry. Now we are raging about talking about destroying our community. So the very things that Millie Mel mentioned in the message that were wrong are now being romanticized on the records. But again, I mean, hip-hop has to do what it had done before, which is when the mainstream media does not speak to the interests and speak in the vernacular of the people, to our needs and what we have to do, we have to take it to the streets and do what we need to do. And it's going to do that. Conditions are going to bring that about. And we have to spearhead and vanguard it like we did before. And even when we see a perversion of our image, we're going to have to stand in the gap. There's a void now. So really, to change this is being active. I don't think young people don't want it. I think they do. I think they're thirsty for it. But they're going to eat whatever's on their plate. And right now, what they're being fed is garbage. So the community ultimately is going to be responsible for where this direction goes. And so Aerosol is one of those entities that's standing in the gap.
For people who don't know, can you explain what Aerosol is and what you're about to do?
Aerosol is two things. It's an organization of Black African spray can artists in the diaspora that have come together to discuss, as well as to be active in the communities around how we're going to use the spray can art hip hop genre to draw attention and focus not only to our historic artistic legacy, but using it in a manner of how we're going to get our people free. Very similar to the work that you would hear audio-wise of a KRS-One, a Public Enemy, Brand Nubians, and Queen Latifah back in the day, Native Tribes, and you know, and such, and Jungle Brothers. We're doing that in the visual sense, and it's something that we're saying, hey, we have a talent. Mm-hmm. But how do we galvanize a movement? How do we draw attention to the needs that we have to do? And how do we, as Black men and women, take responsibility with our skills and activate our young people? Not just sharing with them the work that we can do, but sometimes just creating a space where they can do what they need to do.
Right.
Because there's so much creativity naturally in you. Sometimes you don't have to teach them what to do. You just have to give them the tools and give them the space to do it. So opening up the doors. And those of us that are pioneers in hip hop, we already understand how difficult that is. So we know how to open those doors up now that we're in positions where we can. So it's activating the community. The second part is, like I said, the activism in the neighborhood of creating the visual landscape. If you live in a community that is dilapidated, that is suffering from a lack of our cultural values that we have lost and been in a nosedive loss since integration, we have to reclaim our visual landscape. Music artists have to reclaim the soundscape. Everything around us culturally should be controlled by those of us who are looking out for our interests.
That's
when we
talk.
Do that, things will begin to change.
That's the voice of Reefa One talking about Aerosol as we are talking about the image challenge that was presented around the Trayvon Martin case, but it's not limited to Trayvon. We can talk about how Oscar Grant was dehumanized and Alan Bluford, Sean Bell, and it goes on and on and on. Mark Anthony Neal is also our guest. He's written a book, Looking for Leroy, that deals with male image, black male image. Mark, in your book, you cover an array of images that's out there, and I know we've been focusing on the youth, but a couple of questions for you. One, a lot of adults, you know, who should have the maturity that Reefa was talking about don't. And they have bought into very limited images about themselves. And even more harmful, they have brought into limited images and how they see the people out there. And I think you alluded to that when he said, we'll help Trayvon, but not Ray Ray. You see what I'm saying? And so we got that type of scenario going on. But also, a lot of us don't even know the array of images that are out there and how to navigate and the type of challenges we have in terms of navigating this world and how we change our image and shift it versus really coming into our own in a way that is fulfilling. It seems like we're in reaction to everything that's around us. So can you speak to how you lay that out in your book and talk about that?
I think it's so important what the brother was just talking about, because what he's really talking about is us getting back to the business, to creating culture that allows us to navigate everything that we're dealing with at this point in time. When you think about, you know, Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit in 1939 or Nina Simone singing Mississippi Goddamn, these were women in this instance who were creating culture that allowed us to respond to what was going on. And culture is something that you can pass on generationally. Right, in ways that it's actually more easier to pass on culture than it is to pass on history in that kind of sense. And the particular challenge that we face now in the digital era is our young folks are bombarded with more images and more information than any generation of folks who've ever been on the earth. But they're not necessarily equipped with the kind of critical blinders that allow them to decipher what images are of value and what have not. Typically, they respond to whatever makes them feel good at any given time and any given period. And so part of what we have to do is actually do a better job, not just in terms of the creation of images and sounds and culture, but do a better job in supporting people who are doing that kind of work. I mean, I think that's why, you know, what the success that we're seeing and the kind of critical attention that Fruitvale Station is getting is important, because here you have a young filmmaker who just felt compelled to tell this story in ways that Hollywood was never interested in telling this story. So how do we get better about supporting independent black filmmakers who are actually doing films that are telling our story? I mean, how many folks, even as we talk about Fruitvale Station, ever saw a film like American Violent, you know, from a few years ago that tells that same story in terms of the criminal justice system around the situation of a black woman? How do we get better about supporting independent artists? You know, a brother like Jasiri X, who literally has been on the front line now for almost a decade in terms of doing critical work in hip-hop that responds to our political realities, that we know that we're never going to hear him on mainstream bourgeois black radio. He ain't getting played on Tom Joyner in the morning, you know, as an example of that. So we just have to get really better and vigilant about supporting culture that supports our community.
Well, in addition to that, how do we, you know, let me kind of rephrase my question. I agree with the support. How do just individuals kind of find their own? You know, I pick up your book. What do I pick up out of it? What do I go home with? I go to an event like the aerosol that Reefa's putting on, you know, to you, Reefa, what do I pick up out of it? You know, how do I start to know what to take in? Or will that be self-evident once I step into the place or once I turn your pages, I'll be able to pick that up? Because you're right, I am being bombarded with a bunch of stuff. And so even as I pick up things that I think are wholesome, I'm still being challenged, like, well, you know, your gallery show is pretty good, but I still want this Love and Hip Hop that's on VH1 that I just saw the advertisement for. Sure, I may want to go see Fruitvale, but, you know, they just have the, you know, the gangster thug movie Shoot 'Em Up Bang Bang that's coming up, even from the same company. You see what I'm saying? So there's a lot of confusion on that. So what do I pick up from these things? And maybe I'll start with you, Mark, and then go to Reefa.
I never take for granted that someone can read my book and somehow come away enlightened. But, I mean, the learning process just doesn't work that way. Very often it takes much more time for people to be able to process information, whether that's in terms of words or visual music or otherwise. But I also think it means that those of us who are producing information in this way have to always be engaged with the audiences that we want to make sure are connected to our work. I mean, in that way, I think social media is incredibly important. I mean, you know this, Davey, for the work that you do in social media. You know, we have to always be willing to take our work where folks are and to engage them in those kind of spaces, you know, to do translations if we need be, to be able to understand that our work also needs to be able to exist on multiple platforms. So the book is going to represent a certain kind of thing to a certain kind of audience, but, you know, that book distilled on a blog or on a webcast is going to reach a very different kind of audience, right? And we have to be willing to engage all of those platforms so that folks understand what we're trying to do with our work.
Reefa, same question, and, you know, I'm going back to the conversation we were having on Saturday where you showed me a picture and you said it's important that we remind people what the essence is, because oftentimes stuff gets lost in the translation. You know, I might look at something that really has a message that you're centering on, and because of what I'm influenced by, I pick it up differently. And then when I'm outside the community, you know, a cultural piece that's supposed to really resonate with folks all of a sudden gets seen in a totally different light based upon all these isms and schisms that exist. So, you know, your work is now vandalism versus art. You know, the images that you put up there are, you know, less than human. versus being something that really may represent something a lot deeper.
Well, one of the key things about aerosol is being in control of your narrative. And this is something that has been taken away from our people. And oftentimes people have been manipulated into believing that the narrative that is being told is theirs when it is not, particularly in Hollywood. But I would say, you know, in the spirit of hip hop, I mean, you can't just come with a positive message. You have to deliver a positive message in a dynamic way. When we are painting in the hood, we're not just putting a message on the wall. We are seducing your senses. So even if you don't connect to what the message is I'm putting on the wall, you connect to the dynamism of the work. Wow, bro, that's hot. That's wet. How'd you do that? How'd you learn how to do that? They're going to run to the wall, and now I got an opportunity to engage. Our people culturally respect high levels of technique in our culture and like skill and discipline. And so now it gives me an opportunity to talk to this youngster and to engage them. Plus, visually, how often do you see black men and women with a high level of technical skill and ability painting in the community? What's so great about mural work is that it's public. If I'm in my studio working in painting and the community doesn't see it and I'm only showing in the galleries, I'm kind of disengaged from the community. Doesn't mean I'm not doing positive work, but the impact that I will have as an artist out in public and young people being able to see that, even if they don't speak to me, plants a seed in their mind that we can do great things. And even if I don't want to grow up to be a painter, I will use my voice, my skill, my abilities to do that. So aerosol is really trying to vanguard also a movement and just all artists and everything. Get out into your community, do the work, and have faith in our culture. There's great advantages to using digital media, yes, but we have to remember the biggest African organization in this country and the most successful African organization in this country existed before the telephone. The UNIA, Marcus Garvey and them wasn't all on the phone all day. They didn't have internet, but they did more work in the black community than all the black organizations we have in this country together combined. So putting forward something positive and getting active is what it's going to take. Our youngsters are waiting for us to do our job, and we need to demonstrate and give them an example of what to do, and they will do it. And that's why they're being bombarded. Even the enemy knows hip-hop is the key. That's why they're putting billions of dollars into something they wouldn't even put on MTV years ago. So they saw the power of it when it came to its maturity. We just need to get our children back.
You know, also kind of alongside that is an absence of history. You know, history has been presented as something that we don't need to really connect dots to, and maybe even see it in a limited way. Oftentimes we talk about history, it's like memorizing dates, times and places.
Right.
And we're taught that, you know, every 5 years, you know, it's something new and we don't have to look at it. Whereas I think both of you would agree that if we're talking about art that comes from, you know, our community, that it's timeless. A Stevie Wonder from 30 years ago is just as relevant today as it is now. A piece that you did 20 years ago on the wall in West Oakland is just as dynamic and just as vibrant as it is today. Sure, you may have new ideas that reflect the maturity and a new outlook, but there should be no reason why we throw away the past unless it was moving us in another direction.
And that's a Western concept. African people never throw away their past. Our culture is timeless. Even hip-hop brought that forward. So they would play the records of our elders and some ancestors and bring that information back forward to the industry decided to disrupt that. But we have to take it back to the street.
Well, they disrupted it in ways that prevent the challenge in a sense of control. So, you know, you go and sample James Brown and now you owe some record label, you know, $1.5 million. You know, you use somebody's image. All of a sudden, this intellectual property is owned and controlled. And I bring that up because it seems like, as you said, it's a disruption. But it also seems that as a way to prevent generations from coming together. It also seems as a way to prevent the community from coming together. And that seems to be always at play. How do you see that, Mark?
Oh, I agree with that. You know, I'm fortunate every year to teach a class on sampling with the Deuce and Ninth Wonder. And part of what we always are telling students, particularly, you know, when sampling was very popular and you could do it without being smacked down, you know, by publishing companies, it was a way to bridge a generational gap. you know, you're sampling some classic Grover Washington that your mother and your father listened to, you know, that gets recontextualized for a younger generation. It is a way for the community of folks to be able to communicate with each other. When Eric B. and Rakim, you know, sampled, you know, Don't Look Any Further, Dennis Edwards' song, you know, I would argue that was the last moment in which you had older generations of black folks and younger generations of the hip-hop generation listening to the same music, right? Because they all knew what that song was and could vibe on it in different kinds of ways.
Definitely. How do you see it?
I believe we're going to do it again. I have vision. I have faith. The enemy is very afraid of this happening, which is why this is one of the key things that is being used to distract and disrupt our people. They're not going to put all this money into something that they don't think has the potential to have power. Hip hop is a stew of everything African and fresh up to date. It will bridge generations from antiquity to now. They cannot afford for that to be unharnessed. And so it's just a matter of us getting active and, again, bringing that information and history to our young people. I mean, even with this Aerosol show, this show we got coming up called Electric Kingdom is about talking about some of the historic bloodlines in the hip hop spray can art genre, the TMT crew, and giving them some knowledge around that, connecting the dots, letting them know how valuable our legacy is and what our narrative is, and filling in the gaps. Our young people are very interested in this information. Like I said, they eat whatever is on their plate. And if we're not putting healthy things on their plate and they're getting sick from eating the garbage, who is responsible for that ultimately? White supremacy will never, ever fix our problems. It is the enemy. Only we can solve our problems. We may not be the source of creating the problem, but we are the source of the solution.
And I think the key word there is not only being the source to the solution, having faith in ourselves and our people.
Absolutely.
You know, the Aerosol, give the dates and times. How can we get involved with it?
So Electric Kingdom opens August the 2nd, 2013. That's the first Friday. Those of you who are familiar with the Oakland Art Crawl, it's going to start at 6 to 10 p.m. It's featuring some of the legendary members of the TMT crew, the Magnificent Team. It's going to have artwork of Chain 3, the president of the crew, Team 5, Cade, Sack, Scheme, Shame 125th, one of the Harlem legends, Slave from the Fab Five, Web, Stem, myself, Reefer One, Create from L.A., Mad, Khufu, and Ink. So it's the West Coast and the East Coast chapters of this crew, some select members, with special guests Soon One and some photography by Zoraida Lopez. The show is going to run 2 months. We invite everybody to come out and check out the art and the culture and to talk with us. We're going to have an artist talk on Saturday, August the 3rd, from 7 to 10 p.m. And you can get more details about the show and about Aerosol on our webpage at www.aerosolart.com. That's AEROSOULART.com.
Well, there you have it. Mark, how do we get a hold of your book? And do you have any last comments before we move on?
I mean, the usual suspects, Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I'm just hoping that, you know, that we do take this energy to really create this kind of moment that we need to create that, you know, that we've been talking about for the last half hour, you know, to talk about pushing back stand your ground laws, to talk about challenging legal and otherwise stop and frisk laws. I mean, this is a moment that we need to take advantage of.
I would say that collectively, you know, the biggest thing that we can do is reaffirm our humanity day in and day out.
Absolutely.
Uplifted, you know, see it in each other.
Yep.
You know, and be aware of the attempts to undermine it and to undermine our thinking about each other in a humanitarian way. So Looking for Leroy is the book. Mark Anthony Neal is the author. I want to thank you for being on the show. Reefer One in the building with us. Don't forget Aerosol. You can go to aerosolart.com and look out for that thing kicking off on the 2nd, the art opening from 6 to 10. What we're going to do is take a musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Rich Medina. We're going to also be talking about Fela Kuti, so keep it locked right here.
Human beings in a mind, what's a mind to a NBA All-Stars are playing next. But right outside that same city, the celebratory atmosphere would change quickly. Who watches the game with me? You know Lil' Trayvon was repping his hometown, D-Wade and LeBron. He had just came up from Miami to see his daddy. Knew such a great weekend with him badly in a place where you move because it's safe for your family. But some people got an ingrown hate for your family. Halftime, just a short break from the slamming. About to go to the store, no fuzz, you want some candy? Bet I'll grab you some Skittles, kid. I'll be right back in a little bit. I said I'll grab you some Skittles, kid. I'll probably be right back in a little bit. Human beings in a mind. What's a mind to a king? What's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer? Who don't believe in anything? We make it out alive. Cousin Skittles and an iced tea. Walked out the store and felt the chill of the night breeze. It seemed a little colder than before. He didn't know I was a boy like a soldier in a war. Walking through my neighborhood, he fits all the specifics of criminal statistics. He looks suspicious. 911 push your emergency. A black man walking through my hood purposely. Stay calm, it's just Lil' Trayvon. But he wanted to be the hero, so he put his cape on. George Zimmerman, neighborhood block captain. Though they clock strapped in, fake cop has. Got out the car, ignoring what the cops asked him. They always get away, this time that will not happen.
Human beings in a mind. What's a mind to a king? What's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer? Who don't believe in anything? Make it out alive.
And didn't take his Ritalin. Drunk off adrenaline since he's making the citizens arrest. Trayvon looks at him vexed. I just walked to the store, nothing more, nothing less. Just steps from his home, he ignores this request. George grabs him, Trayvon swings and connects. Starts screaming out for help, but Zimmerman sees a threat. So he pulls out his gun and he points it at his chest. He fires but he misses. Trayvon pleads for forgiveness. I didn't do nothing, this is senseless. But George Zimmerman was so vicious, he made sure the second shot hit him. No survivor, no witness. Trayvon never gave his cousins the Skittles. Mr. All-Star game didn't see another dribble, and George Zimmerman wasn't even arrested. The message is only white life is protected in America.